House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. We're going to go out of order on the agenda just for a second. We're going to go to the open and work session on House Bill 2734.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2734 relates to small claims proceedings. You heard the bill on March 2nd. There's a Dash 5 amendment before you that replaces the measure. The Dash 5 amendment authorizes one spouse to appear on behalf of both spouses in a small claims mediation or litigation with the written consent of the other spouse or a written statement under declaration under penalty of perjury. With the Dash 5 amendments, House Bill 2734 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 2734.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 2734. Is there any discussion? I would just say that the collectors group had some opposition originally, but the Dash 5s have resolved their issues.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'd like to thank the staff for working so hard on this bill. I appreciate their work on it.
Thank you, Representative. No objections to the amendments included?
Representative Gorsuch is excused.
And Representative Gorsuch is excused.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2730 floor as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2734 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Again, are any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry that bill?
It's my bill.
Okay. Representative Greenick will be the carrier, and again, Gorsuch is excused. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2380.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2380 creates a crime of threatening a mass injury event, applies when a person knowingly causes fear, alarm, or terror by threatening to cause serious physical injury or death to two or more persons, and it is reasonable to believe that the threat is likely to be carried out. The bill punishes the crime as a Class C felony, and we do not yet have the paperwork.
Thank you. Representative Brendel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson, and committee. Greg Barreto, State Rep, House District 58. And I'm here to introduce House Bill 2380, which deals with a believed oversight in the law when dealing with a potential mass injury event, which we have experienced in recent years in Oregon. And this was brought to my attention a year ago by LeGrand Police Chief Brian Harvey when the police responded to a threat of a potential mass shooting at the LeGrand High School. When working through the current law to address the situation in LeGrand, they found that Oregon does not specifically address this issue in the criminal code. When dealing with a situation such as a mass injury, there were three areas that they could have possibly charged. One was first-degree orderly conduct, disorderly conduct when a person has the intent of inconveniencing or knowingly creates a risk to the public knowing it's false. Number two, menacing. It's when a person intentionally places another person in fear with the imminent threat to cause harm. Or three, conspiracy is when two or more people make a plan to cause harm. The first two, I think, are misdemeanors. The third is possible felony, but it has to be committed by at least two people. If one person is involved in a potential mass injury event, the person does not fall into this category, and thus the introduction of this bill. So Police Chief Brian Harvey was out of the area and unable to testify, but asked Kevin Campbell to testify in his place. So,
thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. As you know, I represent the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As Representative Barreto has mentioned, I'm here today to present, not read, but just present the heart of Chief Brian Harvey from LeGrand Police Department's testimony. In addition, there's some other testimony that's been posted, one from Chief Ray Rao from the NISA Police Department, another from Chief Stuart Roberts from the Pendleton Police Department, and there may be others by now as well. I will not take long. I will note that in 2015, the legislature was invited to attend an event at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Some of you were there. You had a chance to watch a film produced by the FBI called The Coming Storm. It was actually designed to help train police leadership to understand how better to respond to school shooting events in particular. It was moving because what they had done for the first time ever is they'd used a real scenario. It was like a movie to begin with. And then they did after action recommendations based on that. Back up a little bit. We had shown that same movie to the police chiefs and sheriffs gathered at the academy on September 29th, 2015. The next morning at 10:38, there were a number of law enforcement officials that were at the conference from Southern Oregon that got up and left immediately. It was the morning of the UCC shooting. The scenario in the coming storm was almost exactly the scenario of the UCC shooting the next day. And this bill, I believe, Chief Harvey would say, is introduced out of a growing frustration with how to respond to the growing number of these kind of threats to schools, to public places, and others, where it's very difficult to have a way of preventing or initiating prior to the outcomes involved. So I think, as Representative Barreto mentioned, you know, one could argue that the disorderly conduct statutes in ORS 166023 could address this type of threat. The language actually states, and I think Representative Barreto actually read part of it, you know, that somebody with the intent to cause public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, or knowingly creating a risk thereof, the person initiates or circulates a report knowing it to be false. That's the problem, is those that terminology, knowing it to be false, because it does not take into account real events that could be thwarted by investigative intervention. So we believe that language that specifically speaks to the threats and that holds accountable those folks accountable for premeditation is every bit as important as having the reactive statutes we have that address outcomes. The difference can often be evaluated based on the number of lives impacted or lost. So the intent with this law is to name it, name the threat. It's to provide an illustration of how important it is to the state of Oregon that we address these issues, and to create a penalty which is sufficient to provide the investigative tools necessary to hopefully identify and prevent these from occurring. So I did not read the testimony from Chief Harvey. Thank you for the time today to present this on his behalf. I want to thank Representative Barreto for introducing it. Oh, and my phone is talking to me. That's always helpful. With that interruption, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin Neely now that the dramatic moment has been destroyed.
Thanks, Kevin. For the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and in this instance, I'm specifically representing Kelsey McDaniel, the Union County District Attorney, who was in the middle of the situation that really brought this bill to light. But I do want to highlight one thing, this is not a bill that addresses one issue. We have these cases, they are not common, but as Kevin Campbell said just a second ago, they are very important cases, and they really tie the hands of local law enforcement and the district attorney. They have nowhere to land these so that they can make a clear statement to the community and to the individual who is engaged in this behavior that it is wrong, that it is inappropriate, and that it isn't going to be tolerated. So this bill really fills that void in a way that we just don't have right now. So I'm not going to elaborate on the articulate words of the two people on each side of me any more than that, other than to say this is a very good bill that we think will not affect a lot of cases, but those that it does affect are very important.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bio.
Chair Barker, guys, I'm only wondering if the two or more persons piece is really the right way to describe this. I'm thinking about a situation where we've got a 17-year-old that gets ticked off and threatens to beat up or even shoot a couple of his classmates at school with no real intent to create a mass tragedy kind of environment or even threaten that, and ends up with a Class C felony for the threat. I'm just wondering if the two or more is the right level at which to state this and where that came from.
You want to take that? Yeah, the two or more was part of the conspiracy. I mean, in order to charge for conspiracy, my understanding is that you need two or more. Now, if you had just one person, such as down at UCC, that did it on his own without anyone else as an accomplice, that's where there's a hole in the law. And with LeGrand issue, there were two people involved, and that's why they could charge them the way they did. But apart from that, it would have been difficult.
Thank you. Follow-up? Thanks, Representative Barreto. And I have a lot of empathy for that part of it, but what I was referring to was actually on line 6, the threat to cause unlawful serious physical injury or death to two or more persons, rather than to a group of person is kind of what I was getting at.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I would say this. I think that it's really hard to know what those situations look like. And this gives law enforcement and the district attorney the flexibility in those cases where it really is serious behavior to take action. I think in instances in which you had a 17-year-old who posted a Facebook post that was inappropriate but really not meaningfully intentioned, I think it would be extremely uncommon, if not impossible or rare, for a district attorney to take action and create a felony situation there. But it's really hard to distinguish statutorily, I believe, and that's why I believe it's written like this, those cases where there really is a serious intent to do harm to two or more people. And we need to be sure that in those instances we have a tool at our disposal. But again, I hate to use the term prosecutorial discretion. I know sometimes I get looked at sideways, but it really is imperative in many, many cases, not just in cases like this.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlight.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm interested in the creation of the felony in this case. This is a speech issue, and you do want to be able to intervene and find out whether it's real or it's not. But it seems to me for the speech activity, a misdemeanor would be adequate. And I wonder what made you take it to a felony for this as a requirement of intervening.
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlick, and hoping to have an accurate representation of Chief Harvey's intention here, I think it's because of the impact that it is speech, but the impact it has on a community, because I'm going to get totally out of my area of, and I don't have many areas of expertise, but if I said, that it's like, yelling fire in a crowded theater, it's a kind of speech that's really incendiary, and it creates alarm, and it creates fear and impacts, potentially, and I think that's probably why he put it at the felony level, as well as to illustrate, the importance of this in terms of what we're saying as a state about that kind of threat.
Representative Williamson.
I actually have follow-up questions to my colleagues because they touched on a couple of things. So to Representative Vile's point about two or more people, as I read this, this could apply to a lot of situations. This could apply to a domestic violence situation. If you've got two or more people and there's a threat made, there's an additional felony charge of this crime, a mass injury. So how I read it as a fairly narrowly written statute or a broadly written statute for the same reason I think that Representative Vile does. So that two or more troubles me for solving the problem as it's been presented. So I'll just leave it with that. And to Representative Greenlick's point, I, in reading the statutes, and this is for counsel, I see no other speech we felonize without violating some sort of restraining order, whether it's revenge porn or harassment or stalking. I found no other instance of speech-related conduct that on your first offense is a felony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Williamson, I think you've hit the appropriate caveats that there may very well be a stalking-related felony. Disorderly conduct in the first degree, which was referred to, your second offense for that is a felony, but the initial offense is a Class A misdemeanor.
And conspiracy is tied to the underlying crime, right? So a conspiracy felony would be because the crime itself that you are conspiring to is a felony.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Williamson, that's absolutely right. The conspiracy bumps a crime down a level is sort of a simplistic way to think of it. So if it's a Class C felony that you're conspiring to commit, it's bumped down to an A misdemeanor, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Representative Bowen.
Yeah, just as a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of feeling the same way. I really like the idea of addressing this so that we can make sure that we send a message on these things. But I'm feeling like if we worked it a little bit better, we might come up with a bill that had a better chance of withstanding a constitutional challenge and would be more likely to really address the problem that we're looking at. So, and I'd be happy to consult with you on trying to do that. So I Representative Barreto, I really appreciate the effort and hope we can work together to get something done.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Rep. Vile, and I think that would be optimum, you know, because I think the last thing you want to do is produce a bill that has a wrong outcome. You know, there are three attorneys that I know on this panel right here, so I'm a little outmanned here, outpersoned here. but I think that the ultimate goal is to prevent these things from happening and being able to intervene when you have the information. And I have to say, from the information that I've had from this case here, which I think was public knowledge, but there were letters written and who they were going to take out first, second, third, and fourth. So when you get into some of this detail of the operation, it sends the hairs on the back of your neck up, you know. So these are serious things, and to not deal with them, even if it's a first offense. I mean, a lot of these things happen on a first offense. They have no priors, and then all of a sudden, boom, they take off shooting people. So I think it's a difficult scenario, but they're real, and they're happening right now. And I think to do nothing would be wrong, but to give the ability of law enforcement to do something and to prevent them or potentially stop them, you know, would be a need that we have here in this building. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Gail Meyer, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It's a pleasure to come up here in the aftermath of such an already developed conversation, so I can make my comments brief. With respect to House Bill 2380, it was interesting. The defense attorneys for the two boys who were arrested for this in Union County called me when they saw this bill was being introduced, and they gave me the recital of what this case looks like from the defense side. And it was interesting in reading then later articles from the LeGrand newspaper. And they said just that. These were polar opposite conclusions of this case, that the government, I mean, the initial charges were conspiracy to commit aggravated murder. These were A felonies. These were 15 and 16-year-old kids. And they pled to disorderly conducts, which are misdemeanors. And they were completely polar opposite of how able and intentional was this. Was this kids being dumb and reckless with their speech? Or was this something that was a viable threat? And so that was my experience of the case initially, and then when I read it online, that it was concluded that way. I mean, the prosecutor basically said, we have wildly different views about this, and rather go forward than try this out. They resolved it as they did. So with respect to House Bill 2380, we would have two comments, one as to its breadth and the other as to the crime severity. So with respect to the C felony status for speech and speech alone, thank you, Representative Williamson, for your comments there. we could not find any other speech-related crime that was a felony at its first instance. It would be a felony if there were repeat conduct or if there were other aggravators, but in the first instance, they would not be felonies. And that would include disorderly conduct, telephone harassment, giving false information to a police officer, lying about your name or your address, menacing by word or conduct, putting another in fear, revenge porn, disclosing, publishing images on the website, stalking by way of contact. Those are all A misdemeanors in their first instance. And so this would, by calibration, be out of sync with that. Also, with respect to the concerns raised by Representative Vile on two or more persons, we saw that as well. And I think, Representative Williamson, your comment that this could apply to a domestic violence instance inside of a home would be accurate based on subsection A in lines 5 and 6. So some thoughts we had was to exclude perhaps household or family members. But also, there's no qualifier in here of the event occurring in a public place. And we didn't know if that was really the intention here, when you're talking about a mass injury event, whether or not we were talking about an event occurring in a public place that is defined elsewhere by law as a place in which the general public has access and includes but is not limited to hallways, lobbies, other parts of apartment houses or hotels, not constituting the rooms designated for actual residents, highways, streets, schools, places of amusement, parks, playgrounds, and premises used in connection with public passenger transportation. So in my brief communications with Representative Barreto, we've offered an opportunity to suggest ways in which this bill might get more tailored to the instance of what we think they're trying to do.
Okay. Any questions from Aspire? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2380. Representative Peluso here? Yes. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3364 and call Representative Peluso.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3364 increases emergency assistance eligibility and payment limits for victims of domestic violence and persons at risk of victimization of domestic violence. There's a dash one amendment that reduces the applicable period of time from 12 consecutive months to 6 consecutive months, and we do not yet have a fiscal impact statement. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50, the great city of Gresham. I'm here today to ask for your support of House Bill 3364, which increases the grant amount for Temporary Assistance for Domestic Violence Survivors Program. TADVS is provided through DHS under the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, TANF. To qualify for the grant, an individual either has to make less than $616 per month or lack access to their money, as well as have children under their care. When living at this level of poverty, survivors of domestic abuse and their children face enormous barriers to fleeing violence. As of now, the maximum grant payment per family is $1,200, which expires after 3 months. This amount has remained unchanged since the mid-1990s. Adjusting for inflation only, the grant should now be over $1,800. Additionally, the cost of living in Oregon, especially housing costs, have dramatically outpaced inflation. TADVS grants are most often used to cover moving expenses as survivors and their children flee their homes from where their abuser lives. With first and last month's rent, security deposit, and miscellaneous moving expenses, $1,200 doesn't even begin to cover the upfront costs of renting a family-sized apartment. The number of TADVS grants being paid out is declining, but the number of people being approved for grants is not. This indicates that survivors are not able to use the grants they have been approved for before it actually expires, presumably because they are unable to find suitable housing in a period of 3 months. House Bill 3364 would increase the maximum grant amount to $3,000 and allow 6 months rather than 3 to use it. $3,000 will come much closer to meeting the immediate needs of survivors in crisis, while increasing the time allowed to access the grant will give survivors the necessary time to find available, affordable housing before the grant expires. The opportunity to remain connected with DHS for 6 months will also allow survivors more access to case management and other DHS programs. I know from my law enforcement days that it can take many attempts for a survivor to permanently free herself from an abuser. DHS case managers may be able to better help survivors through a crisis, and additional programming is there to help families rebuild their lives. TADVS is a critical resource for the well-being of parents and children facing domestic abuse, but it can no longer adequately meet their needs. I urge your support for House Bill 3364 to allow this program to serve survivors as it was intended. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Representative Bile?
Is that a one-time $3,000 or is that a monthly $3,000?
No, one time.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sorry, Representative Bile, one time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And called Choya Atkinson Stevens.
Hello, Representative Barker, Williamson, Olson, and the rest of the committee. My name is Choya Adkisson Stevens. I am here with the Oregon Coalition Against the Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about our work and then provide a little bit of testimony regarding this bill. So the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, we're a statewide nonprofit organization with 50 member programs, including tribal agencies, hotlines, shelters, culturally specific programs, and drop-in centers around Oregon. Our programs serve adult and child survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. They provide crucial support for survivors seeking to regain safety and self-determination. The coalition, meanwhile, ensures that our member programs have the resources, skills, training, and best practice knowledge that they need in order to provide exemplary services. Collectively, we strive to ensure that the voices of domestic and sexual violence survivors are heard, and that the experiences of survivors inform both the work we do at a programmatic level and also the work you do here in the Capitol. Thank you for your willingness to consider this testimony regarding the importance of passing HB 3364, which is designed to improve Oregon's ability to prevent children being removed from their families, survivors from losing employment or becoming homeless, and the expanding cost of social safety net services. Prior to joining the coalition, I worked for several years in a domestic violence shelter where I assisted countless survivors in accessing TADVS, Temporary Assistance for Domestic Violence Survivors. TADVS is one of the only direct financial supports that domestic violence survivors can access. This is a vital resource and one that has directly facilitated safety for over 10,000 victims of abuse in the 20 years since its inception. It is typically used to pay for relocation costs, sometimes as plane or bus tickets when a family needs to relocate out of state, or most often as a payment directly to a landlord for new safe housing, as Representative Peluso described. We all recognize the pressure and intensity of rising housing costs around the state, yet TADVS has not increased in 20 years since its inception in 1997. Domestic violence and sexual assault create more than just physical trauma, as many of you have recognized in the past. They often require a survivor and their dependents to immediately find new housing, file protective orders, find new employment, and seek professional mental health support. Oregon is second in the nation in rates of domestic and/or sexual violence. In the mid-1990s, the Oregon legislature responded to this alarming reality by creating Temporary Assistance for Domestic Violence Survivors, TADVS. The fund was intended to provide immediate assistance to families in need of quickly protecting themselves. Survivors could apply for a TADVS grant of up to $1,200 to be spent within 90 days to assist in finding new housing, purchase bus, train, or airplane tickets to reach protective family members, or change the locks or any other immediate expense needed to secure the safety of the family. Unfortunately, as you've now heard, the amount has not been adjusted for inflation since its creation, and the fund is no longer as effective as it was intended to be. HB 3364 is a long overdue effort to restore the efficacy of the program. Specifically, it expands the TADVS grant amount from $1,200 to $3,000, a one-time amount, to Rep. Vile's question, to reflect the dramatic increase in housing costs since 1997. When established, the $1,200 grant easily covered first and last month's rent for a family fleeing a violent home. Housing costs across the state have more than doubled since 1997, and the grant amount is no longer adequate. It also expands the time frame in which to use the TADVS grant money from 90 days to 180 days. From my personal experience working in shelter, 90 days is often an inadequate amount of time in order to support a family to access safety, given the tremendous barriers regarding housing and other resources. Again, the dramatically changing housing market in Oregon has made the search for safe housing a more time-consuming endeavor. By expanding the time frame in which a survivor may access the funds, we are improving Oregon's ability to support our most vulnerable families. A few final points. It should be stressed that these funds are not paid to survivors. They are paid directly to the vendors that are enabling each family to protect themselves. It may also be noted that an increased allocation of funds for TADVS will reduce child welfare and other social safety net costs by allowing families to secure housing, safe housing more directly. Oregon still has a long way to go to adequately support survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. HB 3364 strengthens and improves a survivor's ability to take action to protect themselves and their children. For this reason and those listed above, we ask that you please support the passage of HB 3364. Thank you for your time and hearing my testimony today.
Any questions?
I just have one question really quick. I'm just curious. You said that Oregon is number two in the nation.
Okay.
On rapes and sexual assaults. Can you refer, I mean, where are you getting that information?
Absolutely. So in 2010, the CDC released a study called the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, NISVIS. Those results are, the data is easily findable online. I don't have the numbers memorized, but the CDC released state-by-state data regarding a 2010 study. It's one of the most significant studies that has been done in the last several decades in order to provide us with that information. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sanchez, please.
So, not so much a question, but a statement. As a service provider in my other job, I totally recognize this issue. This is something we've been struggling with actually for the last couple of years with people who are suffering from this domestic violence issues and are struggling to find housing. And over and over and over again, we have to figure out how do we supplement that money because it's just not enough anymore. And then how do we help somebody find a place within that short period of time of 3 months? It's just not happening for a lot of families. There are a lot of families who are homeless who have the resources. They simply can't find a place that they can afford. So it's really would be an amazing opportunity to have an increase in these funds to just to support so many victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. So thanks.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. And we don't have the paperwork ready to go on this today, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3364 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3380. You want to go around?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3380 authorizes the Department of Corrections to reduce the term of incarceration for up to 6 months if an inmate meets specified criteria, including participation in parenting-related programming. The bill modifies the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. It authorizes the court to consider eligibility for the program as a downward departure from a prison sentence. It eliminates a prohibition on offenders with previous conviction for person, felony, or sex crime, and provides eligibility for offenders who are pregnant at the time of sentencing. Finally, the bill directs the Department of Corrections to establish a process for selecting counties to participate in the pilot program. There is a dash one amendment before you that eliminates the sentence reduction component, leaving only the modifications to the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I am the state representative for House District 36 in Portland. Colleagues, many of you remember this bill from the 2015 session. We passed the Family Alternative Sentencing Program and launched a pilot on a bipartisan basis in the last session. And this program was built off of the Washington model of this program. That reduces recidivism and has better outcomes for families and kids in that state. So we copied part of that model and institute it here. So this initiative was designed to provide parents intensive supervision and programming and services instead of going to prison, so they could be both accountable, but they would be strengthening their bonds with their kids, and their kids would stay with the family and not be DHS involved, thus increasing family stability across the board. Since we launched this program, 75 people in Oregon have participated in the program with a total of 139 children. Of those 75 individuals, only two participants have been revoked and sent to prison. While it's too early for the Department of Corrections to report on outcomes, they have noted positive changes in the individuals who are participating in the program and the stability of the family. So this program has met some of its intended goals, but there are some gaps that we've heard back from counties that have launched this pilot. And the law has unintentionally excluded some of the parents that providers would have liked to put into the program to have them eligible for the program. So this bill with the Dash One Amendment does two important things. One is to allow pregnant women to enter the program and be considered eligible. And the second is to allow the court a downward departure in order to make someone eligible for the program. So it's important to note that this program was about diversion, and it's in connecting services for folks that we diverted from prison who met the eligibility so that they would have services in the community and remain with their children. And currently the program is operating more as a probation program than a diversion program. And I'm hoping that this we continue to tweak this program to allow more people to become eligible and to allow more parents to get the services they need to be held accountable for their crimes, but to not have the collateral consequences of having children go into the system when we can provide services in the community to stabilize those families. So I urge an aye vote, and I hope that you support this program. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the good representative?
No, I was actually thinking, oh, I should have been down there.
Oh, yeah. You want me to sit here?
Yeah.
Okay.
We didn't call you. No, go
ahead. Call me later. Chair Barker, representatives, committee members, and Vice Chair right here. Tana Sanchez, House Representative for District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Happy to testify in support of House Bill 3380, the Family Sentencing Alternative Program. Through my work at the Native American Youth and Family Center and with Red Lodge Transition Services, I've come in contact many times with families and people in our community who would have been so amazingly happy to use a program like this, but whether it's qualification or somebody obviously who's gone to prison prior to this coming into play, it is just such an amazing opportunity for folks to have an alternative to going to prison, in particular for moms. I think one of the things that's a biggest issue for us is diverting folks away from the child welfare system and kiddos in those long-term placements in foster care. We have obviously an overrepresentation of, in particular, communities of color in foster care system, as we do in the criminal justice system. I see this as an amazing opportunity to reduce some of those numbers as well. Again, one of the issues that I see all the time is that the majority of women that I've worked with in the criminal justice system in prison have gone in for an alcohol or drug-related crime. And that is something I think that if we can work on some diversion for those issues, that would be really, really important to their ability to stay clean and sober, to take care of their children on a long-term basis. Another issue that I think that is, very difficult for me, recognizing that in particular young moms, pregnant and parenting young moms, having a baby in prison is really, really a rough situation. I've seen it a couple of different times of young women going into prison pregnant and having to give birth in prison and immediately give their child to someone else. It's a difficult situation to watch, and if we were able to make that happen for young women, or any woman, obviously, who was pregnant and or parenting, this would just be an amazing opportunity for them to.
Okay. Representative Vile.
Can I add one comment? before. We keep talking about moms. In Multnomah County, I think it's evenly split between moms and dads. So yes. this is really about family stability across the board. I think our intention when we first passed this is we thought it would, it would apply to more moms, and we could look at the diverting women out of the women's prison. At least I know in my county, it's been equally applied.
Thank you, Chair Barker. And I've sat here now for the last couple of months, and I've even said to Representative Sanchez that I really appreciate your perspective coming from a life where I just don't see these things. It's really helpful to have that perspective. How do we know that we're not putting someone in a place where they might harm another member of the public by allowing for this downgrading of the supervision level?
I can answer that, Chair Barker, Representative Vile. I think that the criteria for entry into the program is strict. It doesn't apply to mandatory minimum sentences, so it doesn't apply to person crimes. As Representative Sanchez said, the vast majority of women in the correctional system are there because of drug, alcohol, or mental health. And so the key to this program is providing intensive supervision. When we were first talking about this program, we talked to some folks in Washington State who were providing these services. And in some cases, the parole or probation officer would go to the house every single day and supervise parenting and teach these folks how to be better parents. I mean, the level of supervision is much higher than if somebody were out on parole or probation without these kinds of services. And we funded additional services, additional specialized parole and probation officers to deal with this, and an additional FTE and DHS, so that the two agencies were working together to ensure that the right people were in the program and they were getting the right supervision, along with the right accountability. Because I think, to not lose sight of the fact that these are folks who committed crimes and there needs to be some accountability for that, the appropriate accountability. But if there's a way to keep the family together, then in an appropriate way, everybody does better.
Thank you. Follow-up? And Representative Williamson, how's the cost of that really intensive supervision compared to the cost of a bed in a prison?
I could have told you that in 2015 when we first introduced this bill. I don't know it now. I don't know if the good sub-co-chair over there knows it. No, I won't put you on the spot, Representative Stark, but there may be someone behind me who knows the current figures. I'm guessing there are some experts on the program coming behind us.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, let me also add that might include the numbers for a child in child welfare as well. So if you think about whatever that is, I can't remember either, but I think, a large number as well for a child in a child welfare system.
In other words, you separate them and you've got the bed plus you've got the child out in there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Williamson.
What?
I'm sorry.
Line
finger.
Representative Williamson. Aye. And Representative Sanchez, thanks. This is a really exciting program. I'm glad to see that it's continuing to exist and refinements are being made. As we're thinking about the cost, I know we have a major budget shortfall that we're trying to manage through. And is it reasonable to think that if this works well and continues to work well, it can also contribute to our ability to forego opening an additional wing at the women's prison? So that cost factor is also relevant.
Representative Barker, Representative Leininger, that was actually what started us, a group of us exploring programs that were working well in other states. So programs that were not gender specific, but had a disproportionate impact on women in the criminal justice system and criminally justice involved. And that's what started us down this path. I have the numbers up there of the number of people in which counties and the gender breakdown that I can share with you. But that's the hope, is that it's a diversion program, not just an additional intensive probation program.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Call Larry Bennett, Tira Hubbard, and Shannon White.
Good Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Bennett. I'm the Community Corrections Administrator with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to share information related to House Bill 3380 and the Family Sentencing Alternative Program. As Representative Williamson said, Oregon's FSAP program was modeled after a similar program in Washington State, which was created by House Bill 3503 during the 2015 legislative session. The goals of the program are to address the specific needs of parents involved in the criminal justice system, to reduce the utilization of foster care when the parent is not a risk to harm his or her child, and to address the increasing numbers of those incarcerated by considering probation as an appropriate sentence in cases where better, more intensive local options are available. Multnomah, Washington, Marion, Deschutes, and Jackson counties began their programs in their jurisdictions in January of 2016. And with the support of DOC and Department of Human Services, we've seen the following successes. During 2016, we had 75 participants in the program and impacting the lives of 139 children who would have otherwise ended up in the foster care system. To date, we've only had two participants revoked and sent to prison. And although anecdotal, involved parole officers supervising this population are reporting increased engagement and motivation of the offenders, as well as increased in enthusiasm about the future as a family. And we credit the successes to the collaboration that's going on between the parole officers and the DHS caseworkers. Overall, the participation numbers are small, and the program has room for growth, thus the need to remove some of the criminal history restrictions. With passage of this bill, the courts will be able to consider a greater number of participants who are already eligible for a departure from prison, but due to criminal history restrictions or the fact that they were pregnant at the time of sentencing and didn't have responsibility for a minor child at that time, they're not able to be considered for the program. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Go ahead.
Chair Barker, committee members. For the record, I am Tira Hubbard, parole and probation officer in Jackson County, who supervises the FSAP program in my community. I have worked for the county for 8 years. Prior to that, I worked as a victim's advocate with domestic and sexual violence victims for a period of 13 years. Coming into this pilot project in Jackson County, we have 9 current participants, all of which are females. That includes 19 children that I supervise as part of this pilot project. We have considered some fathers for the program, but they were ineligible due to criminal history, as well as approximately another 10 or so women that we have deemed ineligible for the program because of their criminal history. What we find is in order for moms, essentially women in offenders, to score high enough on the sentencing guideline grid to qualify for a downward departure, they oftentimes have some sort of person felony or mandatory minimum in their criminal history, which can disqualify them from the program. So that's been a bit of a roadblock for us getting our full numbers. In addition to that, I have a lot of firsthand experience in working with these families. So the best way to sort of relay that to you is just to share you a couple of stories of working with these families through the FSAP program. So first off, I'd like to tell you about a woman. I'm going to refer to her as Marie. She is a mother of 3 children. She was a full-time criminal justice student in our local university. She was maintaining a 4.0 average in school and was a couple of terms away from graduating. The father of her children introduced her to methamphetamine in addition to dealing drugs. She was arrested and got a delivery charge. During this time, her grades tanked, her children were taken by child welfare, placed into foster care, dad absconded the area, and mom was involved in the criminal justice system. She was already on probation on her downward departure and was facing revocation to prison. We rolled her into the FSAP program as a last-ditch effort to try and reunify this family. We got her into some gender-responsive programming, helping her with her parenting skills, with her financial stability, with her relationships. She's been reunified occupied with her children. She started school back this term as a full-time student at our local university to finish up her degree in criminal justice. Her children are stable and happy. I spend a lot of time with this family. We've sort of implemented a bit more of a mentoring role in Jackson County through the FSAP program. So it's focused on building trust, focusing on the underlying root problems associated with women in the criminal justice system. What we find is that abuse and trauma is one of the underlying factors. When we're looking at the criminal pathways for women into the criminal justice system, it differs from that of men. Women oftentimes have child abuse or sexual abuse histories, which in turn, they develop mental health issues, and then they start self-medicating through drugs and alcohol, poor relationships, eventually end up participating in drug offenses, property crimes, and whatnot that rolls them into the criminal justice system. By just treating the addiction and the criminality and not looking at those underlying root causes, we're just treating the symptoms and not the virus. So what we've implemented is moving on curriculum, seeking safety curriculums, really focusing on the abuse and trauma aspects of women's criminality. In addition, we've implemented statewide, not just as FSAP, but as a state, the Women's Risk Need Assessment. This is an assessment tool developed by the University of Cincinnati, which effectively looks at women's risks, needs, and strengths and helps us to better be able to case plan and address those root causes. I'm one of the state trainers. I've completed approximately 150 WERNAs, short abbreviation for them. Approximately 150 WERNAs. Of those, only two of them have not noted abuse and trauma as part of their risk needs assessment. So really focusing our services on those elements so that we don't continue those cycles within the children and within the moms. When we're looking at what does a trauma-informed or gender-responsive caseload look like, one instance that I just like to provide is the concept of observed UAs. So an observed UA can be a very vulnerable experience for anyone. For someone with sexual abuse or domestic violence in their history, it can be a very upsetting part of their supervision. So one of the things we've done is try to implement the use of oral swabs or doing UAs with trauma-informed trained staff. Another way is which how we deal with relapse. Occasionally relapse happens as part of the recovery process. When relapse happens, rather than throwing a mom into jail and creating more trauma for the family, using this mentor and relational sort of form of supervision, we get a lot more disclosures in addition to those oral swabs. We get disclosures. They talk to me about their issues. They ask for help. And we're able to do early interventions and create safety plans to keep kids in the home and to keep mom clean and sober throughout the term of her time in FSAP. One last story to share, which is one that just sort of touches my heart. One of the moms in the program, she was using frequently, and she was living in flop houses, and her child had been removed from her numerous times by child welfare and sort of placed back. We had this touch-and-go situation, and mom was arrested often in front of the kiddos. So when I first started supervising and working with this family, the kiddo had really sort of traumatic reactions to law enforcement. So when I'm out in the field doing my home visits, I'm dressed for safety, which means I have on a bulletproof vest, and I'm wearing my badge, and I have on a duty belt. So I present as an officer. Every time I would come to the house, the kiddo would have a fear reaction and would go and run and hide behind the couch in fear of all the times that law enforcement had arrested his mother. Over the course of the last year in supervising this family, this kiddo started to develop relationship with me. At first, the only way that he could interact was if he pretended to be a dog. And so every home visit, he would pretend to be a dog, and I'd scratch his belly, and we'd do tricks. We've built from that to him sitting on my lap and reading stories during home visits to now I just want to share this cute little photo of him with mom's permission, because kiddo now plays with my handcuffs and uses my flashlight, and I keep little cop mustaches in my office drawer when he comes to visit, because he would like to be a police officer when he grows up, and he plays with little police cars during our home visits. So if nothing else, for this one family, being able to watch the development for this kiddo from a fear of law enforcement and seeing them as the bad guy to now seeing them as someone in their life who's safe, is keeping mom safe and helping mom to be the best parent that she can be. So just like to finalize by saying that the difference in this program is working together with offenders on the common goal of helping them to be the best parents they possibly can be, taking a gender-responsive, trauma-informed mentoring role with them allows them to be able to work with us rather than against us. And we're seeing the benefits of that. Of the 9 women, we haven't had any revocations. We've had to use hardly any local resources for jail time just by being able to build mentorship. I'm happy to, pleased to also announce that the Oregon Association of Community Corrections is in support of this bill. And so that pleases us to no end. We'd really like to see this work continue.
Thank you. Thank you for coming up today. Long trip.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shannon White. I'm the deputy director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a nonprofit that advocates for public safety policy solutions that prevent crime, create safe and strong communities, and help both victims of crime and people who've committed crime rebuild their lives. I'll be quick because I know you've got a long list, and I see that look already. But I do want to put this in context and remember that this bill did come in 2015 when we were looking again at having to open a second prison for women. And the real goal of this bill was to help divert parents, but particularly women, from prison into more intensive supervision and services to help keep them reunited with their families. And the program has been hugely successful in many ways, but has not become a diversion program. And unlike the Washington program, which did emphasize really moving people from being prison bound into probation, this one has more been used for supplementing probation services. You know, there are upsides to that. Fewer people are probably being revoked, but it hasn't had the impact that we had hoped, and that's part of the reason that we're back here today and supporting the recommendations that came out of the Department of Corrections report on this, and was also when I, along with other staff from PSJ, went around and visited all of the sites where this was happening, and uniformly we heard that there were exclusions around prior history crimes that were preventing people that would otherwise be eligible into the program. Not allowing pregnant women who are pregnant at the time of the crime, into the program was an area where we needed eligibility. But we also added to this bill, as you've seen, that being eligible for the program could be a mitigating factor to be used in a downward departure. And that is our effort to get to the prison-bound population so that we're actually having the intended impact of this bill, which, has a couple million dollars allocated to it. And we want that to go to the people who need the services the most. So that's really the focus of our bill. I'll say that the amendments to the bill aligned it with some DOC recommendations, also took out a back-end portion of the bill that was also modeled after the Washington program that would release people from prison. Law enforcement was very concerned about that. We hoped that by maybe not pulling this in the bill, we could gain some more support. That may not be true, as I'm sure you'll hear about in a little bit. So those are the amendments that are in front of you today. And I just want to reiterate that this bill, while we do talk about it in terms of preventing the need for prison, is really one that strengthens children and families, strengthens women who are often addiction-driven, have histories of trauma, and we believe it's a good program, but we need to dig a little deeper and make sure it has the intended impact.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on this group? Anne?
Thank you so much for your presentation. I thought that... Ms. Hubbard, I thought that that was a really beautiful articulation of why the program is meaningful, so thanks for bringing the photo, and thanks to the family for sharing that. You have mentioned, the presenters have mentioned up to now, that there are additional communities of people who might benefit from being served by the program. It sounds like pregnant women would, with this legislation, become eligible. Could you talk more about whom you think would be well served but is not currently included in the scope of eligible people? Any of you?
Representative Leninger, Tira Hubbard, I can speak that the ones that we have deemed ineligible, it was because of either their underlying criminal offense or their prior criminal history. So they had some sort of person felony or some sort of mandatory sentencing requirement associated with their current criminal history. So that's what I was mentioning regarding the sentencing guideline grid. In order to get high enough, in order to be looking at a prison sentence, it oftentimes requires that that there have been significant criminal history to qualify for a downward departure. So we have had moms who have had person felonies with the abuse and trauma. Oftentimes, we're not looking at a pattern of violent behavior. We're looking at sort of domestic violence-related instances, not directed at their children, and they're not an ongoing safety issue.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll call Mary Sell. Ulapana, and then looks like Kale Gonzalez.
Did we have a third?
Go ahead. We do have a lot of people to speak today and another bill to go. So.
Absolutely. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to testify here today in support of HB 3380. I am Mary Sell, and I'm a representative of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA's members do see firsthand how incarceration impacts families in criminal, juvenile, and dependency court, as our members are tasked with representing parents, juveniles, and children who intersect with the system. As we all know, involvement in the criminal justice system is often generational, and this program offers a unique program to help parents and children escape the cycle. As written, HB 3380 aims to fine-tune the existing family sentencing alternative pilot program by broadening the eligibility factors, removing certain restrictions, and establishing eligibility into the program as a mitigating factor. Why I'm testifying is I do want to address that mitigating factor language. Framing eligibility into the program as a mitigating factor will help highlight to the sentencing court that this program its purpose is to be used for defendants who are eligible and could and should receive a downward dispositional departure to probation in order to enter the program. My understanding is that the program has not reached its full potential in diverting parents from prison. With this bill, the sentencing court will be able to consider in some sentencings, among other things, a defendant's eligibility into the program at sentencing as support for a downward departure. In some types of cases, defendants will still need to meet certain criteria before being eligible for a downward. But this bill's intent is to help highlight to sentencing judges that people who are eligible for this program should be considered for it. The mitigation factor language is not being added to the official list of mitigation factors as outlined by statute. That would be ORS 137090 or the Oregon Administrative Rules. Rather, this statute is referring to mitigation in support of a downward departure for entry specifically into this program. What this means is that when a judge is deciding whether to sentence a defendant to a downward departure to probation in order to place them in this program, the court is to consider the eligibility as a mitigating factor. The intent is to allow the judge to use the eligibility as what we call a substantial and compelling reason to sentence the defendant to the program. Practically speaking, someone's eligibility into this program as a mitigating factor won't actually be relevant in really any other situation except where the person's eligible for the program and the judge's intent upon learning that is to actually sentence the person to the program. And so our perspective is that, as written, this is self-limiting. OCDLA sees this change helping highlight for sentencing judges that eligibility in this program should be a real consideration taken into account when determining whether someone should be sentenced to probation. We thank you for the time to testify here, and we do urge your support.
Okay, we'll go to the next, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Kalpana Krishnamurthy, and I'm with Forward Together. Forward Together supports House Bill 3380, the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, because we believe it leads to stronger families and safer communities. Forward Together is a multiracial organization that works with community leaders and organizations to transform culture and policy. Our mission really focuses on women, youth, and families, making sure they have the power and resources they need to reach their full potential. We all know that the Family Alternative Sentencing Program program is one that works. Passed here in 2015, FSA was built on the idea that by keeping families together, Oregon can break the cycle of poverty and crime and increase public safety, creating stronger families and safer communities. We know that imprisonment tears families apart, and it dramatically disrupts the lives of children, who themselves are much more likely to become involved in the adult or the juvenile justice system. More than 70,000 children here in Oregon have a parent who's incarcerated. As a result of having an incarcerated parent, understandably, 80% of these children will need higher levels of service. That's 56,000 children. In addition, the system impacts multiple parts of the Oregon state system as well. Over 40% of children in Oregon's foster care system have a parent who's been convicted of a felony. But those are just the quantifiable costs for the state of Oregon. There are also families bearing the burden of the cost of incarceration and of having a loved one who's been incarcerated. Forward Together's original research found that families pay both the obvious costs about court fees, but also all of the so many other costs. For example, many families lose income when a family member is incarcerated. They struggle to meet basic needs like paying fees, supporting their loved one inside the criminal justice system financially, and bearing the cost of staying in touch. The vast majority of these costs are borne by women. In 63% of the cases in our survey, the family members on the outside that were primarily responsible for those court-related costs, it was family members that were responsible for them. And in 83% of those cases, it was women. We also know that given the disproportionate rates of incarceration in communities of color in our state, it's Oregon's families of color and Oregon's women of color who will often bear the responsibilities for the costs of incarceration that get passed on to the families in our state. So Forward Together supports and supported the original legislation and supports 3380's updates to the program. We believe that making pregnant women eligible for the program will give newborns a better chance at bonding with their parents during an absolutely crucial period. And we want more qualified parents to be reunited with their children as they serve community-based treatment. We urge you to pass 3380, the Family Sentencing Alternative Program.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kate Gonzalez, and I'm the political director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. I'm filling in today on behalf of Julia Yoshimoto. She's our Women in Prison director. She has submitted testimony for you. The Oregon Justice Resource Center is a public law firm that represents justice-involved individuals and advocates for criminal justice reform in Oregon. We administer several distinct projects, one of which is the Women in Prison Project. Through this project, we hear directly from women incarcerated at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. And in light of time, I won't go into details about the stories today, but I will stress that it is an absolutely terrifying and confusing experience when children are abruptly separated from their mothers as a result of incarceration. In some instances, these children are placed with family members that had no plans to care for them, or they are shuffled into foster care. OJRC strongly supports FSAP for the reasons that have been outlined here. I'll just point out that by allowing this intensive community supervision to hold offenders accountable, FSAP not only reduces the prison usage, but also redirects these children out of state custody of the foster care system. That's very much what I would call a win-win. The OJRC has long championed forward-thinking approaches such as FSAP. In 2014, at our Women in Prison conference, we invited participants from the Washington State Parenting Sentencing Alternative Program to our annual conference. And since that time, hundreds of parents have successfully completed the program in Washington. With the bipartisan launch here of the program of FSAP, we're very hopeful Oregon can also achieve similar results in improving outcomes for justice-involved families. So I'll just be brief and say, on behalf of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, we strongly urge you to support HB 3380. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Angel Bean, Jacqueline, and Teresa. Okay. You go to any order, please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Okay.
Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Angel Bean, and I work for Pathfinders of Oregon at the Center for Family Success, and I'm here today to once again testify on programs for the HB 3380. I testified in 2015, and my story is that I'm a mother of three, and I was incarcerated in 2003, and after being released from an alternative program there, still considered an inmate, I still had a lot of programming that I needed to do, and I could not find where to do them. There was no direction for me. I hadn't finished any parenting classes. There was just so much more life experiences that I needed help with. I was raised in a dysfunctional family, in and out of DHS care myself. So there was some trauma, and I was trying to better the lives of my three children. And I was released in November of 2003, and I did not find the Center for Family Success until like May. And it wasn't for the lack of not trying. I knew that I needed to do programs, and I just didn't know where to do them. I finally got approached at a support group meeting. And somebody told me, you can take these classes. They're free. And I was on it the very next workday, calling, doing my intake. I got to do so many other programs there, you know, got the ball rolling. I only had supervised visits. My kids were separated. There was no bus that went to go visit my children. I couldn't drive. I had to like do all this on the bus. So, you know, first I did my parenting class, you know, and I was like, okay, I got a little bit, you know, I got one notch done, right? And I'm like, okay, I need more visits. Here's a holdup. You can't get out there 45 miles away from Portland to see your children because there's no bus. There's, you don't have a license, you know. I just kept, you know, giving them flyers of activities that the center might have been having or campouts that were recovery related. You know, I was trying to fix this big gap. My kids were seeing therapists. I had to start seeing therapists. Then we trying to come together to do family therapy was a struggle. Somebody actually, I had to get a friend to commit to a weekly, okay, she's going to pick me up at work. We're going to go to a DHS office closer to my work so that we can do this. But I had to find all that support on my own, you know. If I would have had the wraparound services, I don't think it would have taken me 5 years. It took me 5 years to get my sons home. And one of them didn't come home. He had made it to the age where he had voiced his opinion and he wanted to stay with his grandmother. We have great relationships now, and we've had that conversation that I longed for forever, you know. But that came after buying a house. You know, he finally seen, hey, my mom's doing this stuff. My mom's speaking and giving testimony, and, you know, he's proud of me today. You know, I broke that cycle for my children, you know. All of them finished high school. They all have careers. They've never been in trouble with the police. They've never smoked. They've never drank. They have never used drugs. Thank you, Jesus, that I turned it around for my children. Because my parents didn't do that for me. And I give that credit to my motivation and all my support at the Center for Family Success, because they gave me an advocate. They gave me those services that I'd been asking for while I was locked up, that I was asking my PO, I need to do this. Well, I don't know where to send you. I fought so hard. You know, I had the same judge for DHS two times in a row. When I got out, she said, nope, I already gave him back to you once. Not doing it. That's why I wasn't getting any referrals. I have been honored to have a luncheon with that judge and discuss that relationship, 10-year relationship. And at the end of that lunch, she made me cry by saying that I truly was an angel of courage because I never gave up on my children. I fully passionate about programming. It works. If you give them the wraparound services and you give them that support, they can succeed. And now I get to give that back to our clients. We offer the parenting class. We offer the caring dads class. We are now, I'm co-facilitating the moving on curriculum for the moms. You know, I'm a recovery mentor. I get to support these families.
We need to wrap up a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Go ahead.
We have some clients here, so.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Redthunder. I am 31 years old. I have been battling my addiction for about 10 years now. While in my addiction, my behaviors have taken me to some very dark and lonely places. I was in prison 7 years ago behind drugs. Even lost full custody of my 3-year-old son. Last year, I made a poor choice, which would have landed me in prison for about 4 years. That gut-wrenching feeling of knowing, of being in jail, knowing my possibility of being sent to prison again, there's nothing like it. But I'm grateful that happened to me, because instead of being sent to prison, Multnomah County chose to give me another chance, to give me light when all I could see was dark. This program I chose has not been easy by any means. The last few months have probably been the hardest months of my life, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. I'm currently in a women's rehab center and have had to look at all aspects of my life and now I can change my behaviors to make better choices in my life so that I may once again begin to be a mother that both my son and I deserve. FSAP is a program of accountability and responsibility. It's not there to hold your hand. That's what prison is for. Prison is easy because you have no choices. Living in society is challenging. However, it does get easier, and with the support of programs such as FSAP, in my case, has helped me tremendously become aware of myself and supported me when all I wanted to do was fail. Today, I have a job. I am about to complete treatment and get my son back full time. Believe me, there is no better and independent feeling than to know that I chose this. I can be a better person, and I am.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Trista Kildow. I have a 9-year-old son. Several years ago, I was overwhelmed by drug addiction. I was arrested several times in 2015. Instead of prison, I was given the opportunity to attend classes at Parenting Inside Out at the Center for Family Success. I also completed outpatient treatment at LifeWorks Northwest. I am in support of the Family Sentencing Alternative Program because these programs changed my life immensely. I needed programs, not prison, to deal with my trauma that I went through as a child and as a young adult. And I got that. And after I got into those programs that I needed, my desire to drink and use went away completely after I was able to address that. Today, I have 2 years of sobriety. I have full custody of my son, and I'm finally able to be the mother, sister, and daughter that my family deserves. By helping others in my community, it's my way of making amends for the damage I have done. And I have just started my new job as a parent mentor at Morrison Child and Family Services, where I get to help people who were where I have been. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and thank you both for coming down and testifying. That's in all three of you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Joseph, Teets, and Elizabeth Kushwa, and Tim Callahan.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Joseph Teets. I'm the executive director of Pathfinders of Oregon that runs both the Living in Freedom Today program at the Women's Prison as well as the Center for Family Success from the clients you've heard. In addition to being the executive director, I'm a clinical psychologist, and probably most relevant, I'm also an adopted parent of two children that we took out of the criminal justice system so that they didn't have to be separated. And we are kinship care providers for those children, in addition to our biological children. We are in a unique position. I'm in a unique position to see both the impact of incarcerating both men and women, as Representative Williamson has noted. We run graduations for folks who do these parenting classes in prison, and you see the children that visit and the impact that it has. I know personally from the experience of bringing the two adopted children that we have to prison to visit their father, how impactful that was and how traumatic that is. Long-term, longitudinally, if you look at the cost of that, I can tell you both in terms of mental health, trauma, educational goals, and the vast majority of children in foster care who have parents incarcerated, the costs are astronomical. If anything we can do to prevent those children from having those experiences, particularly given the fact that the vast majority of men and women who are in prison are parents and have committed nonviolent property and drug addicted related crimes, there's a better way, there's a cheaper way, and there's a more ethical way. We see anecdotally, as Representative Williamson said, it's too early with the 75 women in Multnomah County where the Center for Family Success is. But we see anecdotally the impact of working with those women and men when they have their children in the community, that we can work on those parenting skills is very different from working on those skills while they're incarcerated. It's a whole different ball of wax, and it's a much more effective and less traumatizing approach. So I really urge you to support HB 3380. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Kushwa, I'm Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon. I have submitted written testimony for you, which contains statistics, but let me tell you what those mean. Children are disproportionately affected when a parent is and traumatized when a parent is incarcerated. Arrests, trials, convictions, incarcerations, these events and the trauma that goes with them create adverse childhood experiences. You've heard of ACEs scores in other committees. They affect the health, the educational attainment of kids, and they are a strong predictor of the child's future involvement in the criminal or in the juvenile justice system. This bill can help to keep children out of foster care, help these particular children. And the wraparound services that keep kids at home and keeps those homes stable and safe. Children First and our partners at United for Kids support HB 3380, and we hope you do too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Tim Colahan, Executive Director for the District Attorneys Association. I too have submitted written testimony, so I'll be as brief as possible and outline what the concerns of the District Attorneys Association is. Oregon's DAs absolutely support the Family Sentencing Alternative Program. We agree with the changes to the eligibility requirements that are contained in Section 1, Subsection 2. We wholeheartedly agree that trying to keep families together and maintaining public safety is paramount. Our concern has to do with the language it's on lines 27 through 29, which would make eligibility for the program as an independent basis for a downward departure. And our concerns about that are twofold. Number one, presently, people that are identified as being appropriate for the program are headed for prison. They're presumptive prison folks. And these people, after they are identified, they receive a stipulated downward departure by the parties to make them eligible for the program, which means that the district attorneys are working in connection with our public safety partners, community corrections, and law enforcement in identifying appropriate people for the program. Our concern about this is that, and we agreed to expand the eligibility requirements based upon the knowledge that the DAs would continue to perform the gatekeeper of this program. The language as it is written, our concern is that it would make individuals eligible for downward departure, but because of the way it is written, they may not be required to go through the programming, and that is a concern to us. So that's, as it is written, that's the problem. We support the changes of the eligibility. Those changes actually are contained in Senate Bill 895, which had a hearing yesterday in Senate Judiciary. We testified in support of that bill.
Thank you. Well, Chair Barker, I would love to work with the district attorneys to tighten this language, because the whole point of it is to allow the court to downward depart in order to put somebody into the program. So if it's not written clearly enough for that, then you should tighten that up.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, the bill's not ready to move today, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3380 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2633.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2633 creates a prohibition on practicing as a sex offender treatment provider without a certification issued by the Health Licensing Office. There is a dash one amendment that replaces the measure. The amendment creates an additional certification level as a certified secondary associate sex offender therapist who is authorized to provide limited sex offender treatment services, exempts certain current practitioners from the certification requirements until 2021, and replaces the definition of sex offender with a definition of sex abuser. With the dash one amendments, House Bill 2633 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Call Michelle Roland Schwartz, Kelly Chimant, Mint, and Elena something. I can't read the last. Got the carbon copy sometimes doesn't come through real clear. Balder Z or something. Anyway. Okay, please go ahead in any order and identify yourself for the record.
Great. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide nonprofit, non-governmental statewide agency with over 100 multidisciplinary members who serve on our task force and help us advance our mission to support a multidisciplinary, survivor-centered approach to the prevention of and response to sexual violence in Oregon. I do serve on the Sex Offender Treatment Board, and so for the record, I want to say I'm not here on behalf of the Treatment Board today. I'm only here on behalf of the task force. And I'm here to support House Bill 2633, which would increase public safety by ensuring that any person who has sexually abused or who has been accused of sexual abuse receive high-quality, ethical treatment services by a certified treatment provider. For a little background, the Sex Offender Treatment Board was established in 2007 following the passage of House Bill 3233, and Oregon Health Licensing Authority oversees the Sex Offender Treatment Board and I believe is here today to answer any questions about the jurisdiction of the Treatment Board, if you have questions about that specifically. The SOTB was the first step toward recognizing sex offense-specific treatment as a specialization and positively impacted sex offense-specific treatment by developing professional standards of practice and guidelines. The jurisdiction of the Sex Offender Treatment Board, however, only extends to providers treating adjudicated sexual abusers, even though it was always the intent of the Treatment Board to outline standards of practice for therapists treating all individuals receiving sex offense-specific treatment. So passage of House Bill 2633 would affect the following. It would expand the jurisdiction of the Treatment Board to include non-adjudicated sexual abusers or those at risk of abuse. It would safeguard the public by establishing that only those certified under the Practice Act can practice sex offense-specific treatment services. It would change the definition of the Oregon Adolescent Sex Offender Treatment Network to the Oregon Adolescent Sex Offending Treatment Network due to an organization name change. And an amendment would establish a third tier of certification to address the scarcity of treatment providers in rural and frontier Oregon. Outlined in the amendment of the bill is a certified secondary associate sex offender therapist who would provide limited services for the treatment of and rehabilitation of sexual abusers under the direct supervision of a certified clinical sex offender therapist. Treatment providers assume a vital role in protecting the public from sexual abusers who remain in the community, and protection of the community can be undermined by a lack of regulated and approved practices. And moreover, it is critically important that the treatment treatment professionals who have been charged with reducing recidivism and rehabilitating sexual abusers have the specific education, training, and skills necessary. And for these reasons, we urge your support of House Bill 2633. And while I'm available for any questions, I would defer any technical questions about the bill to the next three experts who are actually treatment providers in Oregon.
Okay, please,
thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Comenti, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker with a private practice in Portland, and I supervise a team of therapists who also provide sexual offense-specific treatment. I've been certified as a clinical sex offender therapist since 2009. I'm president-elect of the OATSA board and vice chair of the Sex Offender Treatment Board, but I'm not in that here in that capacity today. I'm representing the OATSA board today. And I've also submitted some written testimony that describes OATSA's mission for your review if you're interested. OATSA supports this bill because it promotes the goals of OATSA by providing structure that will help secure public safety by ensuring that sexual offense-specific treatment is ethical, evidence-based, and utilizes up-to-date standards of practice. An ethical sexual offense-specific treatment reduces the efficacy of treatment and increases the likelihood of recidivism. The bill also ensures that treatment is provided by professionals who are appropriately trained and supervised, which enhances public safety and competency. It broadens the jurisdiction of the Sex Offender Treatment Board, like Michelle mentioned, which addresses previously unintended problems with the narrow definition of sex offender. HB 2633 supports practitioners as well by ensuring that there's a focus on training and supervision. The bill moves the profession towards consistent standards of practice by providing therapists with guidelines and ensuring evidence-based practices and the most current and effective sexual offense-specific treatment is used, and this reduces recidivism and keeps communities safer. The legislation will help ensure competency for professionals who are practicing in good faith and accountability for those who are not. For all these reasons, OATSA asks for your support. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, may I ask a question?
Yes, you can, please.
You were a licensed clinical social worker. Were you
correct.
Not trained as you became a licensed clinical social worker to treat sex offenders?
So Chair Barker and Representative Greenlick, that is correct. I had no specific training in sex offense specific treatment.
But you had no specific training in other areas as well that you treated without getting certification.
That is correct.
Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to get at, the bill does allow other certified mental health practitioners to, within their scope of practice, to treat sex offenders. Did I read that right?
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlick, this bill would require practitioners who hold a license, the professional license, to get a certification in the associate's level 2, which we added on to just for the purposes of folks that want to work in this field but have no specific training or supervision. So the amendments to this bill will allow folks to do just that. So to get a minimal amount of training and also to have supervision by a clinical level sex offender therapist while they are treating sexual offenders so that they can have some guidance into the most effective treatment.
I don't have the bill up. I was reviewing it a few moments ago. There was an exemption for mental health practitioners operating within their scope of license. I believe in it. If it didn't, it should, but I think it does. You say that a psychiatrist, certified clinical psychologist, a psychiatrist is not qualified to treat patients. They would need a special certification.
Chair Barker and Representative Glean, I'm going to defer that question to Katie Gotch, who will be providing testimony. She can specifically speak to the exemptions in the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Elena Balduzzi. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in Oregon, and I'm also a certified sex offender therapist. I have over 25 years experience in the treatment and assessment of adult sexual abusers, and I'm here today with specialized knowledge in this area that I've applied as a subject matter expert working with, contracted with the Oregon Health Licensing Office. They have, in the last few years, contracted with myself and Katie Gotch to review complaints that are filed against certified sex offender therapists and provide recommendations and opinions as to the relative merits of those complaints. The reason I'm here today and the reason I got involved in trying to remedy some of the unintended consequences of the bill that was passed that established the Sex Offender Treatment Board was because a number of the cases that I evaluated and found had relative merit ended up not going anywhere. They could not be referred to the Sex Offender Treatment Board and reviewed, further processed, and possibly sanctioned because those complainants were either unadjudicated sex offenders and that was primarily the issue that resulted in a number of cases that I had reviewed essentially falling through the cracks. Frankly, I was very concerned that there were providers, certified sex offender treatment providers, who did not were not held to account because of this distinction that has no difference. All of us who work in this field work with the full continuum of individuals who've been accused and or convicted of sexual offenses. We don't make that distinction, but the law does. And so there were people who were providing unethical treatment, questionable practices that continue to treat individuals today without having been held accountable. The other area that was concerning to me was, which I would characterize as an unintended consequence, was the issue of unlicensed certified sex offender treatment providers. Back when the Sex Offender Treatment Board was established in 2007, there was a grandfather clause that allowed individuals who met all the other criteria but lacked a license in another mental health field from they were allowed to become certified. However, there was no provision in the law that required them to become licensed. 10 years later, many of those grandfathered in certified sex offender therapists, without having any incentive or motivation to become licensed, continue to be unlicensed. And it's some of those folks who also could not be held to account because some of the practices that fell outside the narrow scope of sex offender treatment but would have been regulated by a mental health board were not being regulated. So this, I don't believe, was the intention of the legislature back in 2007. Passage of this bill would require licensure and provide a reasonable amount of time for those individuals who are currently certified to obtain a license. And as a licensed psychologist, I think it's very important that we have adequate regulation of the full range of professional activities that are conducted by those who work with sexual abusers, even those activities that fall outside the narrow scope of sex offense specific treatment. So those are the two primary areas that I think motivated me to get involved participating in the development of this bill that's before you, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Representative Vile.
Chair Barker, I'm just want to make sure that originally the bill had a definition of sexual or sex offender. That's now been redone as sexual abuser. Is there anywhere else in the law that being termed a sexual abuser would get you on a list or on a report or anything like that? Are we, because we've kind of expanded who a sexual abuser might be, and I'm concerned that might have some consequences we didn't anticipate.
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Vile, to the best of my ability, to the best of my knowledge, the purpose for expanding the definition is so that individuals who are receiving services from certified sex offender therapists who may not be adjudicated for a variety of reasons. For example, they've been charged with a crime. Their attorney has hired someone like me to evaluate them. If I practice in a manner which causes someone to be concerned and they file a complaint against me, it is not within the jurisdiction of the SOTB to sanction my work with that individual because they're not adjudicated. However, they're in the pipeline. They're headed toward some kind of trial phase, and they may at some point become adjudicated. But at the point at which I intersect with them, they are unadjudicated and therefore not covered under that jurisdiction. As for a list, I don't know that there would be any list. The only list I'm aware of is those registrants who are required by law to register as sex offenders. Everyone else is just being shuttled through the criminal justice system.
Follow up. I appreciate that, and I think the intent was certainly good to allow the services to be given, but because of the fact that right now you have to have been convicted or adjudicated of a sex crime as defined in the statute to be called a sex offender, now you would not have to be adjudicated but just simply referred, and I'd sure like to make sure that we didn't have any fallout that might result because we've name some folks that haven't been convicted or adjudicated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, I think everything the witness said is absolutely correct. But I would also note that the definition is limited. So if you look at page 1 of the amendments, line 6, it's limited to as it's used in 675.360 to 675.410. So it has a very limited application, and it is not going to bleed over into, for example, the sex offender registration list.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may. You done with this?
Well, I read that, and I'm not sure that I would have interpreted that the same way, that it actually creates the definition that is created a little bit later in the proposed statute in the amendment. All the amendment did is change the name from one thing to another, but the idea that somebody's got a label and that more people now have that label is what's got me concerned.
If I could very briefly, I'm sorry. I think you could also, a little bit of clever rewriting, get to a point where we're not naming the person as a sex abuser, but we're just providing, we're recognizing the treatment these folks provide.
Mr. Chairman, that may very well be the right approach, and I appreciate that suggestion, Josh. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Green, next again.
Yes, I need to go chair another meeting, but I just want to put on the record page 2 of the bill, line 33 through 35, which points out that this section does not prohibit a person who is authorized to practice a mental health profession other than sex offender treatment under the laws of the state from practicing that person's mental health profession. And this deals with a specific set of people who get certified, who are not otherwise licensed, but get certified under this act. But it does not stop licensed clinical social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, from providing treatment to sex offenders. Not calling themselves sex offender treatment professional.
Chair Barker and Representative Green, actually, what this piece means and is referring to is that this bill doesn't prohibit me, let's say, as a licensed clinical social worker, from practicing as a social worker in any other area.
Or
so
in
it's
this
not.
Area either.
What's that?
Or in this area either.
Well, the intention is that only folks who have the certification can provide sexual offense specific treatment.
Well, it's not what the language of the statute is. The language of the bill says those people practicing under the scope of their license are exempt from section subsection one.
Yeah, we're not going to see you later.
So, Chair Barker and Representative Greenlick, it sounds like we need to maybe clean up some of that language so it's clear.
No, I think you need to leave it in. I just think you need to recognize it. I mean, I don't think you want to stop a psychiatrist from treating a sex offender because he hasn't been certified by this board, he or she hasn't been certified by this board. I just want you to recognize it's there.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, this is proposing a practice act. It would, in effect, require that anyone who elects to practice this specialized area of treatment, in addition to holding a license in a mental health field, whether it's psychology, social work, counseling, would have to be certified. It does move this from a title act to a practice act because we're recognizing that sex offense-specific treatment is a specialized area and graduate school doesn't teach you this. So other than the exempt agencies, there is language that includes the exempt agencies, but otherwise it does require that individuals have a license, and in order to practice sex offense specific treatment, that they have the certification.
Is that in subsection one of this act?
I don't have the act in front of me, and I don't have my glasses either, so.
Well, subsection one is the one that describes this, and this specifically says subsection one doesn't apply to licensed professionals operating within the scope of their practice.
I think it presumes that the scope of their practice it excludes sex offense specific treatment because
it does not. I mean, we license a great many different professions, and you always have to exclude licensed mental health professionals from doing their job. There's nothing in the Medical Practice Act that says psychiatrists, for example, I just picked psychiatrists, cannot practice in this area. Can practice in this area under their scope of practice. And this act makes it clear that you're right, it's not just a title of protection act, it's a practice act, but this specific exclusion is an exclusion to that part of the statute.
I'm going to defer to my colleague who was more involved in the drafting of the actual language. That wasn't my understanding, so I'll respectfully
take this up at some later date. We should get the LC in and make sure that it's clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt.
That's fine. No, that's fine. Good points. Thank you, panel. Call Katie Gotch, Malcolm McDonald, and Sid Moore. For my dwindling audience here, we have other committees going on. People have to go to the other committees. I'm always late to mine at 3, so but I stick it out here. Please go ahead. In any order, just remember to identify yourself for the board.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, really quickly, Representative Greenlick, the issue you brought up, we'll be looking at it because it seems like it's an omission in the language currently. So we'll be taking care of that. So I am Catherine Katie Gotch. I am a private practice clinician, licensed professional counselor, and certified clinical sex offender therapist maintaining a private practice in Portland, Oregon. I'm involved in a variety of different things, which is reflected in my written testimony, which was submitted. I'm also the principal author for House Bill 3233, the initial bill, as well as the content expert and co-author of House Bill 2549, which created the sex offender treatment, sex offender notification and level system. So in a nutshell, the original intent of House Bill 3233 was to cover all individuals who were receiving any type of sexual abuse specific treatment, no matter where they were in the criminal justice process, or if they were referred from the Department of Human Services, Aging and Disability Services, any of those entities. So House Bill 2633 covers and rectifies some of the oversights from the initial legislation and fixes a number of those issues that, as the years have passed, we have seen arise. And The original intent was also to recognize and create standards of practice and evidence-based treatment services for all individuals receiving sexual abuse-specific treatment, and requiring the training and expertise of those individuals providing services. And creating a practice act enables us to ensure that the individuals providing services are properly trained, supervised, and providing evidence-based services. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'll cut mine down in a, my Chair Barker and the one committee member left. Thank you for staying. I represent, my name is Malcolm McDonald. I'm the Community Corrections Manager for Clackamas County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. And we're here to voice our support for House Bill 2633. In short, we're responsible community corrections for over 4,000 sex offenders that we supervise in the community. Sex offender treatment, sex offender specific treatment, is a key part of that community supervision, and we have a very close working relationship with those providers, and we feel of utmost importance that we make it a practice act, and there's an umbrella of accountability for all who provide treatment to sex offenders in the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. this looks like C-SPAN and the Congress. Everybody's gone home.
It does have that character. Thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Leninger, absent members of the committee. My name is Sid Moore. I'm the Deputy Director at the Psychiatric Security Review Board. My comments will also be very brief, but we're here to express support for the bill. And I think most of you are aware of what we do. We monitor those who have been adjudicated guilty except for insanity. Wanted to just share with you a couple of things that this bill would do for us and thereby for the community. So during hearings, we hear testimony from treatment providers, including sex offender treatment providers, and our decisions, our board's decisions, are based on in part those experts. So including that includes placement decisions within the community, and so to have certified sex offender treatment providers who have this area of expertise, who are specifically qualified and subject to discipline if they're not in compliance, helps us with those to have confidence in placing our clients into the community where that is appropriate. There will be fewer wildly out of date treatment methods, which in the absence of that monitoring can happen. Standardized assessment methods and testimony within our board hearings leads to more consistency in conditional release placement, and the ability of the health licensing office to sanction providers when necessary, as I mentioned, would help in this manner. So, in order to let you get to the rest of today's meetings, I will cut my comments short and just say thank you for your time in allowing me to discuss this with you.
Okay, well,
and
thank
we
you
urge your support that. For the bill.
I appreciate that. We'll have get the language. Try to get the language worked out on this. So, close the public hearing on House Bill 2633 and adjourn the committee. Thank you. Public hearing on House Bill 2633 and adjourn the committee. Thank you. Close.